Sometimes we tend to create a false image of the early church. We imagine the camaraderie among believers as idyllic, free of conflict, and filled with harmony as they ignited the flame of religious freedom for generations to come. But actually, very little has changed over time. Our sinful condition, our human tendencies, our relational tensions are eerily similar. Today on Insight for Living, you'll hear Chuck Swindoll continue his dynamic study of the brief New Testament letters. We're looking at 3 John, where the writer builds a strong case for balancing truth and grace in his Postcard of Candid Truth.
Postcards, those glossy pictures of paradise printed on a 4x6 mailer. Ever notice that the scenes on postcards always look better than the actual place? The sun shines brighter, the surf curls rounder, and those palm trees stretch taller. This is what you had in mind when you planned your vacation, not the overcrowded, billboarded reality you saw when you arrived, right? Unlike the postcards in a tourist shop, the postcards in the New Testament don't airbrush the truth about the early church. There was the scorching heat of persecution, along with the flies and mosquitoes of heresy that needed constant swatting. And, like sand in your swimsuit, there were always abrasive believers who rubbed you the wrong way. The first century church was not the Edenic garden spot we like to imagine. And so as we turn to the postcard of 3 John, we see a genuine scene from the New Testament church. You'll find no glossy coating, no special tinting. Filling the entire frame is reality, the good and the bad, together in one picture. As I read all 15 verses of 3 John from the New Living Translation, you'll be able to observe that the first century church was not the Edenic garden spot we like to imagine. So listen carefully as I read 3 John, beginning with verse 1. Here we go. This letter is from John the Elder. I'm writing to Gaius, my dear friend, whom I love in the truth. Dear friend, I hope all is well with you and that you are as healthy in body as you are strong in spirit. Some of the traveling teachers recently returned and made me very happy by telling me about your faithfulness and that you are living according to the truth. I could have no greater joy than to hear that my children are following the truth. Dear friend, you are being faithful to God when you care for the traveling teachers who pass through, even though they are strangers to you. They have told the church here of your loving friendship. Please continue providing for such teachers in a manner that pleases God. For they are traveling for the Lord, and they accept nothing from people who are not believers. So we ourselves should support them, so that we can be their partners as they teach the truth. I wrote to the church about this, but Diotrephes, who loves to be the leader, refuses to have anything to do with us. When I come, I will report some of the things he is doing and the evil accusations he is making against us. Not only does he refuse to welcome the traveling teachers, he also tells others not to help them. And when they do help, he puts them out of the church. Dear friend, don't let this bad example influence you. Follow only what is good. Remember that those who do good prove that they are God's children, and those who do evil prove that they do not know God. Everyone speaks highly of Demetrius, as does the truth itself. We ourselves can say the same for him. And you know we speak the truth. I have much more to say to you, but I don't want to write it with pen and ink. For I hope to see you soon, and then we will talk face to face. Peace be with you. Your friends here send you their greetings. Please give my personal greetings to each of our friends there.
You're listening to Insight for Living. For helpful resources to complement this new study called New Testament Postcards, go to insightworld.org. And now the message from Chuck Swindoll, a postcard of candid truth.
There's something about brevity that makes a message all the more emphatic. I can think of a couple in my life, tucked away and settled down in San Francisco for what I felt would be a good 18-month finishing up of my days in the Marine Corps, only to have a few weeks pass before a message came with a simple message, and it was very brief. Destination, Okinawa, and I was off. Another time came back in 1961 at 8:15 in the morning. That's how well I remember it. I was sitting in the dad's den at Baylor Hospital in Dallas after 9 months of waiting for our firstborn. I thought I was cool and casual looking over the magazine. What I didn't realize is that I had it upside down as I was looking at it. And the nurse came bolting through the door saying, "It's a boy!" Brief, to the point, but life-changing. Things haven't been quite the same since. Happened in the Second World War. It was 2 days before Christmas, 1944. In a little place named Bastogne in southeastern Belgium, the 101st Airborne Division of the United States Army was trapped. It was encircled by Nazi troops. There was no escape. 7 days passed, and all supply routes had been cut off, and it was just a matter of time, it seemed, before they would fall. By and by, the Nazi commander-in-chief decided, "Press for an unconditional surrender." The appointment was given to the major who carried the message to the commanding officer of the 101st, who in good American fashion snatched the paper from the German, looked it over as it required an unconditional surrender, turned the sheet over and wrote in one word the answer, "Nuts!" And they didn't surrender, and they did, in fact, get out of there, many of them with their lives. Something about brevity that makes a message all the more emphatic. Take forgiveness. You would have expected Paul to write a 15, 20-chapter letter on the subject of forgiveness because it's so important in the Christian life. We'd constantly have to forgive. But he picked up a postcard and he wrote a note and sent it by the one that deserved the forgiveness. Or perhaps it's better to say didn't deserve it. And this slave by the name of Onesimus took the message back to his master named Philemon and in a few words pled for forgiveness and I believe got it. Just like a rifle to the bullseye, Paul went right to the heart of the issue and said, "Look, Philemon, you've got the capacity in you to forgive. Forgive!" Exclamation point. Put that on my account if there's any wrong that's been done. In our study of the single chapter letters of the New Testament, we're finding that that's the way they are. Not a lot of words, but a lot of message that's emphasized by brevity. Look at 2 John along with 3 John for a few minutes. We were in 2 John last Sunday morning. We're in the 3rd today. And I want to do some comparing and contrasting for a few minutes. If you haven't the outline from the bulletin, at least build one in your mind. Place on one side 2 John and on the other side 3 John, and let's draw some contrasts. The book of 2 John, or maybe I should say the postcard, was written to a lady and her kids. But the letter to 3 John, the third letter of John, was written to a man and his acquaintances. A man who is named in this book several times. At least he is called by name and referred to as beloved. So the second letter was written to a woman and her kids, and the third was written to a man and his acquaintance. The problem in the second letter, now get this, was a lady who was entertaining the wrong kind of visitors. The problem in 3 John is a man who refused to entertain the right kind of visitors. It's ironic. A lady who said yes to a person she should say no to, and in 3 John, a man who said no to an individual he should have said yes to. And it'll unfold as we get into it. I think the second letter is a letter of truth that needs to be balanced with love. Perhaps I've got it backwards. It's a letter of love to be balanced by truth. Here was a woman who was loving indiscreetly, indiscriminately, all those that came, even the heretics, opened her home and fed them and encouraged them and perhaps even supported them financially. A lot of love, but no truth. Now we have it right in the third letter. That's a letter of truth that was to be balanced by love. Here was a man who was driven by the orthodox, rigid position, and he was unbending. In fact, he was dogmatic and dictatorish, who had no love. So John writes in the second letter pleading for truth, and the third letter he's pleading for love. One other thought that might help you that are of technical mind. In the second letter, no person is named, not even the lady, or her children, or her sister, or her children. Just one, and that's the name of the Lord. In the third letter, there are three by name. Notice them. Get your pencil ready and let's circle them because it'll be an outline for the letter. The first man is named Gaius, verses 1 through 8. His name appears in verse 1. And John writes to encourage him. He's a guy that needed some encouragement, and John gave it. In verse 9, there's a second fellow named Diotrephes. Strange name. We'll hear the meaning of it a little later on. Don't name your child Diotrephes, by the way. That's not a good one to choose. Verses 9, 10, and 11. And third is Demetrius, verse 12. And he is a neat fellow. Very unique kind of guy with apparently a winsome way. A man with integrity all the way down to his toes. There they are. Gaius, verses 1 to 8. Diotrephes, 9 through 11. Then Demetrius, 12, and then the final closing, verses 13 and 14. Look at Gaius with me, will you? It's encouraging. He condemns Diotrephes. He speaks with favor of the testimony of Demetrius, but he encourages Gaius. To start with, he says, this is the elder, that's John who writes it, to the beloved Gaius. You still got your pencil in your hand. Look at verse 1, beloved Gaius. Verse 2, beloved, I pray thee. Verse 5, beloved, you're acting faithfully. Verse 11, beloved, don't imitate what is evil. It's a good friend. Real close friend to John is Gaius. We don't know which Gaius it was. There's a Gaius mentioned in Acts 19, dragged out in the street and strung up because of his faith. And Gaius in Acts 20, traveling companion of Paul. A Gaius in 1 Corinthians 1. A man who was apparently of Corinth, but we don't know which one this one might have been. The name Gaius was as common then as John or Richard might be today. Very common name. So we don't know who to call him except just Gaius. What do we know about him? Well, first we know that he was a sick man. There are 4 things revealed in these first 8 verses about Gaius. And they have something to say today to us as Christians. The first is that he was a sick man. Beloved, I pray that in all respects you may prosper and be in good health. Now, he was praying that he would become well. I want to add here that it is not God's will that every person be healthy. It is not God's will that every sickness be healed. It is God's will that some people live with illness and learn new dimensions of grace and tolerance in their lives. However, it is always God's will that our soul prosper. He always wants our soul to be in good condition, regardless of our body. So not only was Gaius physically sick, he was spiritually well. He was living for Christ. See that? I wish your body would be in good health as your soul prospers, is the idea. I pray that in every respect you may prosper and be in good health just as your soul prospers. Now, how did he know that Gaius was in this condition? Verse 3, "For I was very glad when brethren came and bore witness to your truth," that is, how you are walking in truth. Apparently, there was a steady stream of visitors to John's side that brought the message regarding his friend Gaius. Have you heard about Gaius? Oh, what? Gaius is not doing too well physically, but he's doing well spiritually. He's doing well. He's walking with the Lord. His physical condition has not hindered his spiritual condition. It's a good place to apply that, isn't it? You have friends that are sick. Maybe you're sick physically. You can be sick physically and perhaps more well than ever spiritually. C.S. Lewis is the one that says, "God whispers in our pleasures, but he shouts in our pain." Someone has put it this way: pain plants the flag of reality in the fortress of a rebel heart. Many a proud rebel is thrown on his back in physical affliction. It's remarkable how that pride begins to decrease. That's as close as he can get to his knees, on his back. And he says with the psalmist, "It's good that I should have been afflicted, for now I've learned to trust you." Psalm 119:71 says that. "The affliction was good for me, and I've learned to trust you through it." Mark that down. Your sick friend might need to hear that. The affliction is not without its message. And Gaius didn't miss the message. Okay, I noticed something else about it. Not only was he a man who blended godliness with physical frailty, not only was he just a sick man, but the third thing I noticed, he was one of John's converts. Verse 4, "I have no greater joy than this, to hear of my children walking in the truth." That's very significant. If you've ministered to someone and they have begun to grow, maybe they came to know Christ through your ministry, through your friendship. They've begun to grow. Nothing thrills you more than to know that they're growing in the truth. They're walking in the truth that they have learned. There is very little thrill in just knowing a person is learning more truth. That's not God's goal. It was a long time before I knew that as a Christian. I thought the requirement was just to learn, to know, to discover, to find. But I find God's goal for us is to get into the whole body, the truth that is being learned. I have no greater joy than to hear my children are walking in truth. John R.W. Stott puts it better than I ever could. To walk in the truth is more than to give assent to it. It means to apply it to one's behavior. He who walks in the truth is an integrated Christian. I'd never heard of that phrase before. He is an integrated Christian in whom there is no dichotomy between profession and practice. Thanks, brother. On the contrary, there is in him an exact correspondence between his creed and his conduct. So such conformity of life to the truth on the part of his children brought John greater joy than anything else. I like this. To him, truth mattered. Now listen, Christians that are involved in getting into the truth Sunday after Sunday, truth matters. When it stops mattering, then we stop walking. Truth mattered. He did not regard theological issues as unimportant trivialities. It was from truth believed and obeyed by his children that John derived his greatest joy. One of my goals in ministry is to do everything I can to get the truth into the life, to make that 6-foot journey down the whole of man into the way that we use our hands and the way our minds work and the response we give to the pressures of the week and to the way we respond to criticism or even prosperity and encouragement. John says, "I have no greater joy than to hear my children are walking in that truth." I think it was Harry Ironside, Dr. Harry Ironside at the Moody Church, I read, who often used to say, "God forbid that we should traffic in unlived truth." I'm honest when I say that That is our number one battle in a Bible teaching church, is to grasp truth as an end in itself. It does not bother me that we have gotten through John. What bothers me is that John doesn't get through us. That's the part that concerns me. Not that I can delineate verses and the repetition of words and the tenses of the verbs and the prefixes and the suffixes and all the syntactical muckledy-muck of the passage. What concerns me is, now that I've got a hold of it, what difference does it make tomorrow? Or, if you please, even this afternoon. John says, that concerns me that my guys walk in the truth. Convey that to your disciples, please. That's very, very important. Here is a man who was sick, living for Christ, one of John's converts. Now here's the fourth, and it leads us into a whole new bailiwick. He was faithful and friendly. He was a faithful, friendly man. See verse 5? Beloved, you are acting faithfully in whatever you accomplish for the brethren. Let me read several verses. I want you to get the flow of it. And especially strangers. And they bear witness to your love before the church. And you will do well to send them on their way in a manner worthy of God. For they went out for the sake of the name. Christians were commonly called followers of the way, or people of the name. Capital W on way, capital N on name. They weren't called Christians for a while. Now these people who were believers in the name went out for the sake of that name, accepting nothing from the Gentile. Therefore, we ought to support such men that we may be fellow workers with the truth. Okay, what does it mean? Well, I wrestled with how to teach this, how to explain what that means. And let me put it this way. In the New Testament church, there were two kinds of ministries. To use good old American terms, there were the settlers and there were the pioneers. The settlers were the people who stayed in a local area and ministered to the same local flock. Gaius was a settler. There were also pioneer ministries. The apostles, the prophets, the evangelists were pioneers. They started churches, and when it just got underway, they moved on. And when Gaius saw these ministers coming in, he opened his home to them and was faithful and friendly to them. John said to Gaius, I thank God on every remembrance of you, brother. You help these people in their way.
Well, there's much more from this message we need to hear. And Chuck is in the studio today with a closing thought as well, so please stay with us. You're listening to Insight for Living, the title of today's study in 3 John, A Postcard of Candid Truth. For helpful resources to complement this new study, go to insightworld.org. As you heard Chuck describe the tension between first century believers, it's possible his observations reminded you of a fractured friendship, or perhaps you're in the midst of a painful rift at church these days. Well, Chuck wrote a booklet called Diffusing Disharmony, Seeking Restoration When Christians Collide. If you've never contacted Insight for Living, we'd like to provide a free copy. If you're listening in the United States, call this number, 1-800-772-8888, and mention you'd like to receive the free booklet, Diffusing Disharmony. And before we hear from Chuck, we'd like to express our sincere thanks to our monthly companions. There's nothing quite like having a good friend come alongside us with support that affirms the value of our efforts on your behalf. If you're a monthly companion, please hear and receive our resounding thanks for your confidence in this ministry. And if you're listening to Chuck teach today and you've never stepped forward to make a donation, you're actually the recipient of generosity from a complete stranger. A monthly companion agrees to give, as the name implies, a recurring donation every month. You're invited to join this circle of friends today. The process is quick and simple, but the impact of your gesture is profound. If you're listening in the United States, call 1-800-772-8888 or online go to insight.org/monthly companion. Chuck?
Most of us are fairly good at celebrating milestones, whether it's a promotion, a graduation, or the birth of a child. We know how to come alongside those we love and revel in their joy. However, when someone we love becomes the victim of suffering and loss, we often don't know what we ought to say. Frankly, we feel awkward when in the private spaces of those who grieve. Well, while some may shrink back from involving themselves in those sacred appointments, they are really missing out on one of the great blessings that God has for us. If you need any proof, just open your Bible to the book of Psalms. From start to finish, we read about the intimate encounters between disillusioned people and their loving, compassionate God. Insight for Living's pastor to the United Kingdom, Dr. Terry Boyle, has written a new book. It's called The Way of Lament, A Biblical Approach to God in Times of Pain. I highly recommend his book to you, whether consoling those you love or finding ways to express your own personal angst to God. You'll find biblical wisdom and great insight in Terry's book, The Way of Lament.
And it's available when you give a donation of any amount. If you're listening in the United States, call 1-800-772-8888 or give online at insight.org. Tomorrow, Chuck Swindoll continues his message about a postcard of candid truth. That's Friday here on Insight for Living.
The preceding message, A Postcard of Candid Truth, was copyrighted in 1977, and the sound recording was copyrighted in 2014 by Charles R. Swindoll, Inc. All rights are reserved worldwide.